program. Tom Hartman. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you today. Well, the day after the State of the Union address, and perhaps appropriately enough, the birthday of Thomas Paine, one of the men who, had he not back in the day written The Crisis and then Common Sense, we may not have a United States of America. And so to open this our show today, and we will be getting into in some detail the State of the Union address, and also, of course, today, Super Tuesday, a week from today, but today the Florida primary, the Republicans going at it down there. Later on in the program, we're going to have on Chris Van Hollen, Congressman Chris Van Hollen. He's going to be talking about the Democratic response to the, or the Democrat, you know, broadly, not just the one that was given last night, but the broad Democratic response to Mr. Bush. And in the third hour of our program, we have scheduled Martin Strong from Blackwater USA, the Vice President of Blackwater, to talk about, you know, should we even have private armies? Well, that's the question I'll be asking anyway. But right now with us is Harvey Kaye. Harvey is the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Social Change and Development Director at the Center for History and Social Change at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And in my mind, perhaps more importantly, he's the author of what I consider to be one of the very best histories of the early United States, the founding era of the United States. And if you don't have this book in your library, you haven't read this book, you need to get it today. It's called Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Harvey Kaye, Dr. Kaye, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's great to be back talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming back with us. Harvey, I'm curious, what would Thomas Paine have thought of George W. Bush's State of the Union address last night? In fact, let me just back that up a little bit. The Constitution has very few mandated responsibilities for the President of the United States.
Right.
As I recall, it's only two or three. And there's only one actual thing that he actually has said he has to do. I mean, you know, he's Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, but it doesn't say how. But it says that once a year he shall deliver to Congress a summary of the State of the Union. I did not hear last night any details about the State of the Union.
A very sad comment on the last 7 years, let's say. You know, it was very interesting the way he closed the speech, which brings us both to him and to Thomas Paine, believe it or not.
Right.
He closed with this little story of Gouverneur Morris. He referred to how in the Federal Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, Gouverneur Morris wrote the line, or supposedly wrote the line, "We the people," as a way of, you know, opening up the Constitution and enabling it to pass or to be enacted. Well, it's very interesting that he would quote, of all people, or cite, of all people, Gouverneur Morris. Most people don't remember who Gouverneur Morris was. He was a very aristocratic, very elitist, very wealthy lawyer and merchant in New York City. And Gouverneur Morris had absolutely no confidence and no trust in the American people. He, at times, called us poor reptiles. He absolutely believed that when the United States should take form, that only propertied men should have the right to vote.
Yeah, like John Adams, he referred to us as the rabble.
Right. The three most elitist figures would have been Adams, Hamilton, and Gouverneur Morris. And moreover, Gouverneur Morris was Washington's ambassador in Paris, France, when the revolutionary leaders of France turned on Thomas Paine and threw him in prison. And it was Gouverneur Morris who refused to act to have Paine released. So it's interesting to think that Bush would finish off this seventh State of the Union message, right, by referring to Gouverneur Morris as very elitist, very wealthy man who basically despised the people.
Yeah, and there's a double irony, too, there, and that is that Bush kept referring to the people throughout his speech.
Absolutely.
And you have 70% of the people want us out of Iraq. You've got the vast majority of the people who want to have schools that work. You've got the vast majority of the people who want to have national health care, the vast majority of the people who want to have Social Security strengthened. All of the policies, I mean, I could go through the list, but it's fairly evident to everybody. So many of these policies are policies, A, that Thomas Paine first proposed, and I'd like you to speak to that in his book, Rights of Man, and in other writings, but B, that Bush kept talking about the people, and yet the people are opposed to the policies that he's promoting. I mean, it was almost like Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland, absolutely. I mean, Thomas Paine's contributions to American and world history were really phenomenal. For a start, he was the first person to really openly call for the separation, for the independence of these colonies as the United States of America from the British Empire,
right,
in his pamphlet Common Sense. But even more important than that, and something that Adams and the other conservative founders were afraid of, is that Paine also said, essentially, that these new united colonies or United States should be not simply independent, but they should also be a democratic republic, keeping in mind that the likes of Bush and his ilk, were they had they been around then, would probably have set up a new monarchy.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's funny.
Oh, sure. You know, you had Alexander Hamilton, the first Constitutional Convention. His first speech was, let's elect the president for life, because, you know,
right,
because it's so hard to find good men, you know.
And yeah, you know, on that notion of life or hereditary monarchy, Paine was very funny in his pamphlet, and there's a line whenever I mention this to my students or when I'm out giving public talks, and I quote this line, I always sort of start laughing to myself and have to explain to everyone who I have in mind. He said in this pamphlet, Common Sense, one of the strongest natural proofs of the folly of hereditary right in kings, maybe we should add presidents, is that nature disapproves it. Otherwise, she would not so frequently turn it into ridicule by giving mankind an ass for a lion. And I think that's what we've had in the presidency for some years now. I mean,
yeah.
Paine, if he were to be sitting last night, I mean, if there were such a thing as an afterlife, although notably he believed there would be, he would have laughed to hear Bush of all people talk about, we were sent to Washington to carry out the people's business. I think business is the operative word there.
He would have gone beyond laughing. He would have been like the Code Pink people who they very successfully kept out last night. He would have been, you know, standing up and
right,
yelling from the gallery.
Right, and he would have had his own blog site for sure. Of
yeah,
course.
Yeah. So
I mean, over and over again there were these moments where Paine would have spoken up, because here's the same Thomas Paine who in Paris, France, during the French Revolution, a hero to the French people, as having been the author of Common Sense, writes the great two-part pamphlet, Rights of Man. And in this, he not only attacks British monarchy and British inequality and calls for the French to establish the kind of republic that the Americans have established, he goes on in the second part of Rights of Man to outline what we would consider a social democratic republic.
Yeah, well, in fact, I would argue that much of what Franklin Roosevelt instituted in the New Deal, Thomas Paine had laid out in the Rights of Man back, you know, in the 1790s.
Absolutely, absolutely. And here's in Rights of Man, Thomas Paine essentially called for the establishment of a social security system.
Right.
And this was no joke. I mean, he had in mind that for a start there should be pensions for the elderly. By the way, Paine imagined that if you got rid of aristocracy, that cost alone, that ending that cost would afford the kinds of things he envisioned. So,
yep,
for example, as I said, he wanted to end the aristocracy. He wanted to institute a progressive estate tax, and we know that the Bushies have been out to kill the estate tax for years now. He recommended raising the incomes of the poor, first of all by eliminating all their taxes, but also he wanted to add to their incomes. I mean, he was one of the first people to envision what we would today call a family wage or a basic family.
Yeah, a living
income.
Wage, yeah.
He then wanted, as I think I said, this old age pension system, as the English would call it. He wanted to create a social security system. I wonder if the Bushies have done what I feared, and that is, back in the 90s, if you went to the Social Security Administration site online, you would actually find reference to Thomas Paine as the godfather of Social Security. It's conceivable that under the Bushies, various things have been...
I have a feeling he's been scrubbed.
I mean, he also envisioned a public funding of education. Now, conservatives like to say, oh, no, he wanted a voucher system. But he was really calling for a public system of education in which working-class children would gain an education. And by the way, after Rights of Man, Paine went on to write an even more radical pamphlet, all the more social democratic, called Agrarian Justice, which a lot of people don't read, but it's a short pamphlet. And there he definitely said, you know, God gave the earth for all to share, which means that those who have vast amounts of property, even though we ought not to dispossess them, they have an obligation. He sort of said this as a threat, I think. They have an obligation to pay a tax into the community fund, not as a charity, but as a tax which would then afford all working class people, young and old, some kind of grant and some kind of system to afford education, small businesses, and so on.
Progressive taxation, the father of progressive taxation,
right.
Thomas Paine.
Right.
Harvey Kay, Professor Harvey Kay, his book, and you must get this book. This is extraordinary. Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Dr. Kay, thanks for being with us today. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I love to walk around the world to ease my troubled mind. I left my body lying somewhere in the sands of time. But I watch the world go to the dark side of the moon. I feel there's nothing I can do.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. George Bush last night, the State of the Union address. Some interesting pieces there were to it. For example...
The past 6 years, we've stopped numerous attacks, including a plot to fly a plane into the tallest building in Los Angeles and another to blow up passenger jets bound for America over the Atlantic.
Oh, really? Wow. I mean, here we are with another,
we found uranium coming out of Niger.
A Washington Post on February 10th, 2006. The article, there is deep disagreement within the intelligence community over the seriousness of the Library Tower scheme and whether it was ever much more than talk. Turns out it was never much more than talk. In fact, there were no successful prosecutions of it. February 10, 2006, New York Daily News, quote, there was no definitive plot. It never materialized or got past the thought process. And then he goes on, actually last year, he said in his 2007 State of the Union address, he says, we stopped an al-Qaeda plot to fly a hijacked plane into the tallest building on the West Coast. And just last August, British authorities uncovered a plot to blow up passenger planes bound for America over the Atlantic Ocean. This is an extension of what he just said here. And you go back to the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray. As David Swanson, by the way, pulled this stuff together and pointed out so brilliantly, he says, this is Craig Murray, the former British ambassador, says none of the alleged terrorists had made a bomb. None had bought a plane ticket. Many did not even have passports. Bush says, we've uncovered an al-Qaeda cell developing anthrax to be used in attacks against America. This was last year, he said. I mean, this is just an extension of last year's speech, right? It's Bush recycled. October 31, 2006, Washington Post article says, no. Sorry. The efforts were well short of developing. September 25th, 2006, Washington Post article describes the FBI's investigation of the anthrax attacks in the United States as open but barely active. That's the anthrax that actually happened when there were only two senators who stood between the passage of the Patriot Act that takes away so many of our rights, that eviscerates the Fourth Amendment, that, frankly, true conservatives are as angry about as progressives are. There were only two senators who stood in the way of that. Tom Daschle had expressed some reservations about it and could have prevented it from coming to the floor of the House, of the United States Senate. He was the U.S. Senate leader. This is because Jim Jeffords had flipped from being a Republican to an independent. Suddenly, for that little six-month window there, or for a little less than a year, the Democrats had control of the Senate. Tom Daschle could have stopped it at the floor. And Pat Leahy, the Democratic senator from Vermont, who was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, could have prevented the Patriot Act and indicated that he was inclined to prevent the Patriot Act from coming out of committee. And who are the only two people on Capitol Hill who got anthrax in the mail? Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle. Just as they were saying, you know, we don't want to pass this Patriot Act, and they had to leave their offices, they had to leave all their papers behind, they had to leave all the information that they had with regard to the Patriot Act, and they had the hell scared out of them. And the Patriot Act passed. I mean, this is just an administration all about, you know, fear, 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 and based on, as I said, lies.
The past 6 years, we've stopped numerous attacks, including a plot to fly a plane into the tallest building in Los Angeles, and another to blow up passenger jets bound for America over the Atlantic.
Yeah, and in fact, that one was supposed to be the binary liquids one, where on this program, you'll recall, it was about a year ago when this first came out, this binary liquids. We had an expert on the show, and we actually said, okay, here's how you make a bomb on a plane using binary liquids. The only known way, the most effective known way, and you have to bring a bucket of ice onto the plane because everything, all these two liquids have to be kept below 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And you take that bucket of ice, maybe you disguise it as champagne or something, into the bathroom, and you put a beaker in the sink, and over a period of about an hour, you put one of the liquids into the beaker, and over a period of about an hour, you put the second liquid in drop by drop, very, very slowly, into that second liquid. It produces an overwhelming smell of ammonia, which will fill the plane. But it takes about an hour that you've got to be in that bathroom to do that. After you do that, it forms a precipitate, a crud layer on the top of the liquid. You run that through a piece of filter paper, and then you have to take it out to the plane and spread it out on a seat so it dries completely, and then you will have something which you can ignite. In other words, it's impossible. And yet now you can't carry a liquid in a plane. Louise and I, as you know, we cashed in some frequent flyer miles and went over to London for our 35th wedding anniversary a few weeks ago, going through security in London. Now, this was a plot that was, you know, supposed to come out of London. Going through security in London, they said, you don't have to take your computer out of your bag. And Louise is like, well, what about all my liquids that I've got in this plastic Ziploc? Oh, you don't have to take that out of your bag. We don't care about that stuff. What about taking my shoes off? I mean, you know, everybody in America is getting athlete's foot. There's this epidemic of athlete's foot among travelers in America. What about taking my shoes off? Nah, you don't have to take your shoes off. This is British security at the airport in Heathrow. Amazing. So be afraid, be afraid. We'll go through some of the specifics of Bush's incoherence last night and take your calls on it at 866-303-2270. Coming up next and throughout the program today, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Oh, it's downright nuts what's going on out there. You could even say that it's crazy.
Baby, crazy.
Not just Bush. Oh, here's a good one. I've been in Adrian, Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. Police in Michigan have charged a man with drunk driving, saying he downed two bottles of wine and rode off in his lawnmower to a liquor store in a snowstorm. He was toting four bottles of wine in a paper bag. Well, he said his wife had taken her car to work and the mower was the only way he could reach the store 2 miles away. Mm-hmm. And his blood level was 2.5 times Michigan's legal driving limit. Well, had he made it to, instead of a liquor store, a bar, and had he been in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, he would have at least had a pastor to talk things over with. Pastor plans to put teams of chaplains in local bars in that central Pennsylvania town so they can lend a sympathetic ear to patrons should they need them. Yeah. Little strange these days. Not anywhere near as strange, however, as things like the code that George W. Bush kept speaking in last night.
To build a prosperous future, we must trust people with their own money.
Yeah. Well, I'm all in favor of trusting people with their own money. I mean, that's a reasonable thing to say, except that it's code for we don't need to invest in our schools. We don't need to invest in our roads and bridges. We don't need to invest in the infrastructure of America. We certainly don't need to take care of the least among us. I mean, this gets down to the core difference in what morality is between conservative morality and liberal morality, basically, you know, broadly speaking. Conservative morality tends to be focused on who are you and what are you doing in your bedroom and with whom? What are you smoking? What are you taking? It's all about, you know, the individual and whether people are good or evil. Liberal morality tends to be about what's going on out in public. How can we call ourselves moral if there are homeless among us? How can we call ourselves moral if there are hungry among us? How can we call ourselves moral if there are people who don't have health care among us? How can we call ourselves moral if our veterans can't get the services they need? Basically the things that Jesus laid out in Matthew 21. I mean, the simple, straightforward, this is what we're about as a society. As Michael Moore said in a brilliant movie, in his absolutely brilliant movie, sicko. He said, are we going to be a we society or a me society? And this really is Bush calling for more of the me society. And I'm telling you, Americans, after 26 years of the me society, are saying, we're ready for the we society. 1-866-303-2270. Michael in Denver, listening on KKZN. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Great honor to talk to you. First-time caller.
Well, thank you for calling, Michael.
Well, I just wanted to weigh in really quickly here. Last night, I counted 36 outright lies that Mr. Bush, decided to loose on the American people. And his final act as he exits stage right, to say.
What were your favorites?
Oh, well, wages are up. Yeah, sure, but the rate of inflation has taken a huge leap over Mount Everest, where we haven't even gotten to Asia yet to start the expedition.
Yeah, and then he was talking about how, you know, average taxes are going to go up. Yeah, because Bill Gates, you know, it's like three guys walk into a bar and one happens to be Bill Gates. You know, you, me, and Bill Gates. Our average wages are what, $100 million each?
Right.
Yeah, average wage, average taxes are going to go up $1,000 if you do away with the Bush tax cuts. No, I'm sorry, your taxes and mine might go up $30 or $40. Michael, excellent point, and thank you very much for the call. Well said. Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max, what's on your mind today?
Yes, well, if I could sum up the last 7.5 years, I'd have to paraphrase Jesse Jackson, except it's the evil side. Keep fear alive. That's what it's all been about.
Yeah.
And I suspect before he's out of there, we're going to get some more fear.
Yeah, well, we're certainly getting the words of it. God forbid we should get the actions of it. But, keep in mind, Bush put Cheney, and thanks, call for, Max, for the call. Bush put Cheney, when he first came into office, he gave Dick Cheney two jobs. He put him in charge of the Energy Task Force, which started meeting immediately in secret with Ken Lay and all his friends. And he put him in charge of the Counterterrorism Task Force, which never met until September of 2001. We did no counterterrorism. 56 specific warnings Bush had on the record, you know, that he acknowledges that 9/11 was coming, and he did nothing to prevent this. This was the biggest security failure in the history of the United States. Or was it? Who knows? I don't know. It's, you know, was it a failure? Was it a incompetence? Was it? Who knows? Ryan in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. A couple things. First, I want to applaud you for pointing out several times, at least in the past week, the prodigal ways of airport security. I mean, if a terrorist really wanted to, create mass travesty, why not just stand in the middle of these enormously congested security lines and have his way? I mean, it's really quite ridiculous.
Let's separate the people from the policies here, by the way, as well. I forget which airport it was, but I was going through an airport recently and I showed my ID, and the guy says, oh, you're Tom Hartman. Are you the Tom Hartman on the radio? And he says, I listen to you. I listen to iPods of your show while I'm working. And it's like, whoa. There are good and decent people who are with the TSA. I mean,
sure.
There may be a few control freaks. I've encountered a couple of them too, but
yeah.
They're just doing what they're told. But
right.
There is so much smoke and mirrors here. There is so much, let's put on the show, and yet we're still not checking the cargoes in the bellies of the plane. We're
right.
still not checking the cargo that's coming into our ports. We still haven't protected the cooling pools around our nuclear power plants. Keep in mind, Mohammed Atta's original plan for New York was to fly a plane into Indian Point, which would have rendered a 100-mile radius, including the entire city of New York, uninhabitable for 100,000 years. And he pulled that about 6 months out, figuring that there had to be anti-missile, surface-to-air missile batteries around a nuclear power plant that close to New York City. Turns out there weren't, and there still aren't.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. One more thing. I heard Bush lauding the No Child Left Behind Act last night and saying how enormously effective it's been. Here in Illinois, in the last couple of years, the states have actually dropped their standards. So we've seen an increase in test scores, but that's not really reflecting, true change in achievement. And as a research methodologist, I can tell you that this there's really no good evidence to support what this act has done in terms of improving achievement.
Absolutely. And as a guy who's written 7 books on education, I've done consulting with school districts literally from California to New York from Atlanta to Detroit. I am the founder of a private school in New Hampshire, the Hunter School. HunterSchool.org is the website if you want to check it out. And still on the board of directors. I can tell you that No Child Left Behind is a disaster. Thank you, Ryan, for your comments. In fact, No Child Left Behind, take it beyond that. No Child Left Behind was what caused Jim Jeffords, the senator from Vermont, to leave the Republican Party. And back when I was living in Vermont, when I was writing Unequal Protection, in fact, we went and we sat with Senator Jeffords' staff and some of the people on his staff at his request, and they pulled a congressional, they actually requested. Now, this is there's an investigative arm for Congress that does research just for members of Congress, not for the public. And typically those reports are not made public, although they're not like top secret or anything. And Jeffords had this report done, and he shared it with us. And I quote it in my book in Unequal Protection. And what that report said was that if No Child Left Behind was implemented the way that the Republicans were proposing it, with all the changes that they had made to Teddy Kennedy's original proposal, its main effect would be to turn a $100 million a year testing industry, where they come up with tests, they come up with the questions, and they take a piece of paper that's worth a tenth of a penny, and they sell it for $1 or $5 or $10. In other words, all these tests that these schools have to take, they have to buy from for-profit corporations. So every time a kid gets tested, some corporation is making another $20. Neil Bush, George W. Bush's brother, is in this big time. He's making his fortune now in the education business because of No Child Left Behind. And it would take this relatively small, I mean, a couple million-dollar industry, and turn it into a multi-billion-dollar industry. And it did. And that was enough to make a good, genuinely conservative Republican like Jim Jeffords, a good, honest Republican, leave the Republican Party. It's a disaster. Will in Charlotte, Michigan. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I really appreciated your guest talking about Thomas Paine.
Yeah, Harvey Kay's brilliant, and his book on Thomas Paine is so must reading. It is so good.
I have to make a little correction, though. He said that Social Security was proposed in Rights of Man, which is wrong. It was proposed in Agrarian Justice, which was written 4 years later.
Well, actually, I would suggest to you that it was in both. Rights of Man was one of my books of the month for BuzzFlash, and I went through Rights of Man with a fine-tooth comb and pulled out all the things that corresponded to Roosevelt's New Deal and Social Security. I mean, obviously, he didn't call it that or anything like
right.
that, but it's in both.
I wasn't aware of that. I was aware that he wrote a second edition of the Rights of Man in 1792 where he proposed a progressive income tax.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of dry reading because it's like the 1790s style.
Right.
But Rights of Man is an absolutely brilliant book, and it should be in everybody's library. And Harvey Kay's book about and Will, thank you very much for the call. Harvey Kay's book about Thomas Paine and the founding of America is the best history that I have ever encountered of the early days of this country. It absolutely the best. He's a brilliant, brilliant historian. And check it out. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
I saved up all my money, but it wasn't enough to do the things that I most love. So my mama and my papa sold all their property, 'cause they knew how much it meant to me. I loaded up the pickup and I bid them farewell. I promised I would pay back every cent. All of the money will be well spent. I'm gonna run for president. I'm gonna run, run, gonna run.
Oh, this must be Mitt Romney's song.
I'm gonna run for president.
Yeah, I almost spent $40 million of my own money. The guys, you know, this, frankly, the big Romney-McCain story in my mind down in Florida is that Romney's outspending McCain 5-1, and McCain's keeping even with him. This should be a warning to the Democrats should John McCain become the nominee. You outspending 5-1 and he's still right there with you? That's scary. Bush last night.
Unless Congress acts, most of the tax relief we've delivered over the past 7 years will be taken away.
Tax relief? There were no tax cuts. There were deferrals. Every single one of George Bush's so-called tax cuts was a tax deferral because they were all financed by borrowing from our children and grandchildren. Our children and grandchildren, or you and I, 5, 10, 15 years down the road, are going to have to pay those exact same taxes because that money was spent. And we're going to have to pay it with interest. There were no tax cuts. It's a lie. Anyhow, welcome back. The Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. And George excuse me, Wesley in Georgia.
Yeah, my name is Wesley Brown. Hello, Tom.
Hey, Wesley, how you doing?
Well, do you know how the bill went last night? You know, I know the FISA bill did not pass. You know how it went, the vote was, how close
yeah.
it was?
I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but no, it did not pass. And so right now it's going to be interesting to see how this thing plays out. But what I understand is that it's just, you know, it's going to expire, which means that we're going to go back to a situation where they've got to get a warrant from the FISA court, and they can begin wiretapping somebody, and they've got 3 days to get the warrant, and it worked just fine before. I do agree that there should be some updating of the thing, but, you know, not certainly an amnesty bill. And by the way, they call this the Keep America Safe Act. They should call it the Bush Amnesty Act, or the Bush and his telecom cronies Amnesty Act, or the AT&T Amnesty Act. I mean, you know, come on, give us a break. Karen in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Karen.
Hello. I just wanted to remark, I mean, you made all of these, you cited all these examples of terrorist plots that Bush says he foiled, but they really didn't exist. And all of these lies that he's perpetuating through his final State of the Union address, why can't members of the House and Senate raise their hands and say, Mr. President, no, that really didn't happen that way. Why? I mean, it would make for a very interesting State of the Union address, don't you think?
Yeah. Have you ever seen Prime Minister's Questions?
Pardon me?
Have you ever seen Prime Minister's Questions out of the United Kingdom, out of the UK?
No, not really.
It's fascinating. C-SPAN carries it. And once a week, I think it is, when Parliament is in session, the Prime Minister has to meet in the House of Commons, and he'll get up and he'll say a couple of sentences, and then people start yelling at him, and as they're yelling at them, he has to take those as serious questions, and you know, somebody will go, come on, you can't mean that, that's absurd, you know, here's a da 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 da, and then the Prime Minister has to say, well, here's my policy on that, and it's wild. I mean, it's absolutely wild. But you get it that if you're a prime minister, you got to be a fairly smart guy, you got to know what you're talking about, you got to have the facts at the tips of your finger, and people in the UK are actually watching this. We need something like that in the United States, Karen. Well said. I absolutely agree. Indeed. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Noah in Modesto, California. Hey, Noah.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to thank you very much for giving us a very educational show every day. And I'm currently reading your new book, Cracking the Code. It's a really great reading.
Thank you.
Today I wanted to discuss about what do you think about Hillary Clinton offering this opt out into Medicare and opting out into the FEHBP program, and do you think that would help her boost her and get ahead of Obama?
Yeah, ultimately I think that they're all going to come back around to this. This is what John Edwards started this. Basically saying, okay, we'll let the insurance companies stay alive for another day. You know, just doing away with them, killing them off tomorrow is not going to be something that ever will be politically feasible. But, you know, let's use the language of the free market. Let's use the language, the meme of the day and the language of competition and say, okay, let's allow competition. Anybody who wants can buy, instead of buying from, you know, insurance company A or insurance company B or HMO C, they can buy Medicare. And they can buy it at cost. And the fact of the matter is, because Medicare does not have a CEO who like William McGuire with United Healthcare, made $1.78 billion, it does not have a CEO who's making piles of money. Medicare does not have stockholders who are taking dividends every year and paying a maximum 15% income tax on it, we might add. It does not have, you know, the corporate headquarters with gold faucets in the washrooms. It does not have corporate jets. It does not have a multi-million dollar budget every year for advertising and marketing. It doesn't have salespeople out knocking on doors. It doesn't have, it's not spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbying. I mean, Medicare has all, the thing the conservatives get hysterical about is that people who work for Medicare are members of the union. I mean, you know, they get a decent salary and they get a pension. But that's it, right? So Medicare operates with a total overhead of around 2.5%. And all of the healthcare companies, the private healthcare companies, for-profit healthcare companies, are operating with an overhead that runs anywhere from 20 to 30%. So there's no way that they can compete with Medicare and provide the same services. And so as the Medicare pool gets larger and larger and larger, what you're going to see is more and more pressure to upgrade and improve the quality of services that are being provided by Medicare, because there are more and more people qualified for it. So you've got, you know, more and more of us saying, hey, to our elected officials, damn it, fix this thing, make sure it works right. And Medicare is going to get better and better, and eventually, and, you know, in my conversation with John Edwards about a year ago, or 6 months ago, we were talking about this, and I don't recall if it was him that suggested it or me, but, you know, it would just be a matter of probably 2 or 3 years before a lot of these health insurance companies would simply fold up and go away. So I think that any of the Democratic nominees who say, let's give people the choice. They can buy the health insurance that they want and give Bill McGuire his $1.7 billion in compensation, or they can buy into Medicare. Do you want to pay $12,000 a year for your health insurance, or do you want to pay $3,000 a year for your health insurance? Up to you. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. We've been talking about the President's State of the Union Address. We got the historical perspective. What would Thomas Paine have thought of it? How about the contemporary perspective? Congressman Chris Van Hollen is with us, representing Maryland's 8th District. He serves on the Committee on Ways and Means in the House, as well as the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, but perhaps most significantly, he's chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the group that passes the bucks out to the guys running for Congress. And Congressman Van Hollen, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. The thing that struck me about the Democratic response last night to the President's State of the Union was that it wasn't a response. And I don't want to get off on picking on the governor who gave the speech, but I think that we do need to respond essentially point by point. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what the president said last night and how we should be, you know, the frame that we should be dropping this into.
Well, I think one of the difficulties probably in responding, as Governor Sebelius did, is that there was really no there in a sense. I mean, this was a tying up loose ends, speech. You know, we're looking for opportunities to work with the president in a constructive way in this last year, but his speech left us very little to work with. And I think one of the things that struck me is the issues that he raised are issues, we in the Democratic Congress have not just been talking about, but working on for a while, and where he has stood in the way of progress. I mean, look, energy policy is one example. We put together an energy bill with lots of important components, including getting rid of the subsidies for the oil and gas industry and saying, let's spend this money instead on investing in renewable energy and energy efficiency. The president said, I'll veto that bill. When we worked on health care for kids, he did veto the bill twice. He talked last night about the importance of medical research, but he vetoed the bill for increased funding for NIH, which does exactly that kind of research. And he talked about stem cells, and he vetoed the bill that would allow stem cell research to go forward. So in many ways, I think the country has passed the president by. We see that in the public surveys. What that speech was a status quo speech, and the country's looking for a change in direction.
You know, Louise and I were watching the speech, and afterward, the commentators, Chris Matthews, made the comment to John McCain afterwards that George Bush just gave your speech. It seems to me that particularly McCain, who may well end up being the guy who whoever the Democratic nominee is running against, is just, you know, a continuation of Bush, of what's going on with Bush. To what extent is that, you know, a problem or a benefit for Democrats or for America?
Well, I think it's certainly a problem for America if we have another president in the line of the George Bush policy. And there's no doubt that McCain is now very much in the Bush mold. I mean, at one point in time, he spoke out on independently on various issues. But what's clearly happened is he's gotten into the Republican nomination, is he's now become, you know, captured by the ideological straitjacket of the Bush agenda. I mean, look at Iraq, for example. I mean, McCain is talking about spending 100 years in Iraq. That was the comment he made.
Yeah.
When, in fact, I think we all understand that in order for the Iraqis to begin to take responsibility for their own future, they need to get some signal that we're not going to be there forever. In fact, the Baker-Hamilton Commission on a bipartisan basis said, if you guys want to give these guys an incentive to reach political reconciliation, which they haven't come close to doing, you've got to make it clear to them you're not going to spend, you know, every dollar of your resources in Iraq, and you're not going to be there forever. And so, look, the president sees his legacy tied up in Iraq, and he refuses to admit that he has not accomplished his goals there. And what's ironic, of course, is that September 11, 2001 was the defining moment of his presidency, and yet we're at this point in time when we still haven't gotten the guys who actually attacked us on September 11th. Osama bin Laden is still around, and in fact, al-Qaeda, according to our own intelligence agencies, is growing in strength along the Afghan-Pakistan border. So the terrible event that sort of defined this presidency has never been dealt with by this administration. Instead, we have to spend many years now rebuilding our credibility, rebuilding our moral standing around the world, because we have diminished influence as a result of Bush's policies.
Yeah, we're talking with Congressman Chris Van Hollen, chairman of the DCCC, representing Maryland's 8th District. George Bush last night talking about the Millennium Change Account. He said, we've changed the way we deliver aid by launching the Millennium Change Account. I don't recall when he was in Saudi Arabia talking. He didn't meet with one Saudi dissident. He didn't meet with any of the political activists. Didn't meet anybody, any small-D Democrats, according to Newsweek anyway, when he was there. And the Wall Street Journal says the Millennium Change Program is going to be bankrupt soon. I mean, how can he pitch democracy when what we've been doing around the world has been putting a lot of democracies at risk?
Well, that's right. I mean, if you listen to the president's second, you know, inaugural address, he had lots of great rhetoric about the importance of spreading democracy around the world, and we do have an interest in promoting democracy around the world. The problem is the president sort of abandoned his own policy. All you have to do is look at places like you just talked about, Saudi Arabia, but also in Pakistan, where despite the fact that Musharraf essentially, you know, threw all the judges, independent judges, in jail, put them under house arrest, started arresting lawyers who were protesting instead of going after the extremist elements within Pakistan. And Bush's comment was, you know, that Musharraf has done a lot for democracy in Pakistan. And that just sends the wrong signal to our friends in democratic movements around the world. So I think what you've seen is a huge gap now appear between what the president said he wanted to do and what he's actually done. And that credibility gap is really dangerous, because we want to make it very clear that we stand for those around the world who stand up for democracy. But when you end up saying nice things about people who have declared martial law and essentially taken dictatorial powers, it's hard to send that signal.
Congressman, about 5 years ago, it came out that a member of Orrin Hatch's staff had hacked into Teddy Kennedy's computer, along with about a half a dozen other Democrats in the Senate, and was monitoring their email correspondences about how they were going to respond to judges that were being put forward by the Bush administration. And the Democrats in the Senate were completely baffled by why, whenever they, you know, came forward with a strategy, the Republicans were not just ready, but, you know, just shot it down instantly. It ultimately came out, Orrin Hatch, to his credit, fired the guy, although there was not an investigation. The Republicans controlled the Senate at that time. Still hasn't been to this day. Richard Nixon used the power of wiretapping, used the FBI and the CIA to spy on Democrats, specifically for political purposes. Here, during the Bush administration, we've seen spying on Democrats within the Senate, specifically. There are many of us out there who, I frankly don't think are on the lunatic fringe, who wouldn't put it past Bush to be spying on Democrats and calling it national security. This FISA extension, I mean, I'm curious if you even want to get into this, and feel free to say, you know, no, that's just too far out there. But to what extent you think it may be even conceivable that we're seeing history repeated, that that Bush is another Richard Nixon, that he's been, that one of the reasons why he doesn't want there to be any oversight or any investigations whatsoever into his warrantless wiretapping is that some of it, some small percentage of it, might have been political. And what's the deal with the FISA extension?
Well, I don't know if the Bush administration is engaged in any kind of, overt political wiretapping. I just don't know. What I do know is that early in the administration, you essentially had the FBI and other federal law enforcement agencies investigating what were clearly sort of homegrown peace groups, peace activists against the war. And, you know, suggesting that somehow these guys may be aiding and abetting terrorism, which turned out to be just laughable when it turned out they had, tried to infiltrate groups of people who were essentially pacifists.
Yeah, the raging grannies and the Unitarians and the Quakers.
That's exactly right. So there's no doubt that they've overreached in that way. When it comes to the FISA bill, the House of Representatives has already passed a very good bill that both protects our national security and is true to the Constitution and the protections that every American has under the Constitution. Now, the president says he's going to veto that bill, and they're now in the process of trying to work this out in the Senate. But in the House, we passed a good bill, and we did not provide in the House immunity to the telecommunications industry, because what I think is that the president wants to give them immunity so that we can't figure out exactly what the details of this program were.
Right. I think he's trying to protect himself.
Well,
sir, we're out
right.
of time, but I so much appreciate you being with us. Congressman Chris Van Hollen, representing Maryland's 8th District, DCCC. Thank you, sir.
Good to be with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Our infrastructure's eroding, so what if levees break? For disasters, we're not ready. Bush thinks we'll just eat cake, 'cause a dollar is his true god. The people he'll forsake, business will carry on. Glory, glory, Halliburton.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. By the way, just a quick tip. We've had a number of people saying, hey, wait a minute, that cruise. There's going to be a bunch of us on the cruise. And some of us are going to be coming and going. I'll be there just for the last couple of days of the cruise. Other folks will be there throughout the whole thing. Some people just for the first few days. But, some of the air talent here on Air America and other people associated with us, I think Paul Krugman's going to be there for the whole thing. But in any case, there's a couple of veranda cabins. The cruise has been totally sold out, but there's a couple of cabins that have opened up. There have been a couple of cancellations, and so you might want to check it out. Go to AirAmericaCruise.com or call 800-955-7018 if you are one of those people that I've gotten emails from going, doggone it, I missed it. It sold out on me. Well, a couple of cabins have just opened up, and so last chance, just an FYI. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Herschel in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Herschel, what's on your mind today?
Well, hi there. Well, I was just listening to the congressman that was on here, and he was talking about, like the president, you know, spreading democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow two glaring examples of us not spreading democracy, the coup of Aristide in Haiti and the attempted coup in Venezuela. I mean, it's somehow the Washington consensus is really not interested in spreading democracy and working against it every chance they get.
Well, on a case, I wouldn't make an absolute generalization working against every chance they get, but certainly there have been a number of times in our history, and Howard Zinn is a great chronicler of these, where we blew it. There have been also a number of times in our history where we did the right thing, and I think we need to keep that in mind and hold to our highest ideals. And emphasize those, and let's elect officials who are going to take us to our highest ideals. 1-866-303-2270. Michael in Hollywood, California. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I'm a little concerned about the way the right wing media has been handling the debate and framing questions that actually reframe the Constitution, taking it from hickory to some sort of a plastic. I don't know. Like when I believe it was Tim Ruster that asked Barack Obama at one of the debates, he asked, your number one job is the security of the people in the United States. Now, that might be the number two job, but as far as I remember, the number one job has always been to protect the Constitution, and nobody's talking about it.
Yeah, in fact, the only oath that the president takes is to uphold the Constitution.
Exactly.
The
but why is nobody in the media is talking about this, and the candidates aren't talking about this because our Constitution has been put through a ringer in the last 7 years.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
I mean, if they take care of the Constitution, I'll take care of my own security. I'd rather die than lose the Constitution.
Article 2 of the Constitution deals with the executive branch, the presidency. And Section 1 says who can be the president, no person except a natural born citizen, blah, 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 and when Congress is going to. And it ends, the eighth paragraph, before he shall enter into the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation, quote, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the president of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. End of quote, period, end sentence.
And I
end
didn't hear
section.
Anything about the security of the people of the United
That's right.
States there.
And Section 2 then begins following that. Now we're into Section 2, it's subordinate to Section 1. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Navy, the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states. When called into the actual service of the United States, he may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of the respective offices, and he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment.
Well, our Constitution is under attack.
And that's pretty much it. I mean, it's our Constitution has been under attack for, frankly, a long time. And by the way, you started out by saying the conservative, the right-wing media. I would submit to you that it's the corporate media.
Oh, the corporate media, of course,
There's a fundamental difference in the bias because the right wing has now come to encompass a whole bunch of various and odd fringe groups. The corporate media has really one specific thing that they're dancing to, and that is increasing corporate profit and decreasing the power of government to regulate them and increasing their ability to suck money out of the American middle class.
The conflict of interest.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
thank you. Can you talk about that more, Tom?
I can and I will, and I always do. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Jerry in Florida. Hey, Jerry, just a half a minute here before the break.
Hey, Jerry. Tom, I'm just calling to refer to that Michael Moore comment about the we generation versus the me generation.
Yeah, the we nation, actually. But yeah.
Yeah, my daughter just turned 18, and she registered to vote. I'm proud to say she's going to the polls with me today after work. And I was talking to her about that and how you know, she doesn't want her generation to be remembered as the iPod-listening, latte, self-absorbed generation. Yeah. I told her about the 60s when people hit the streets and they made a difference and they ended a war that would have lasted a lot longer than it did.
You're absolutely right, Jerry. And I see a whole new generation coming up, and Barack Obama seems to be their standard bearer, a whole new generation coming up saying, this is it. It's our time. We're going to take this country back, and God bless them. We need them. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, letting your radio station know you're listening, letting your sponsors know you're listening, supporting their products, and tipping your hat to the folks at SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans who believe keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Strange goings on out there these days. Yes, a Twilight Zone alert here. Just imagine you get on a flight. This is after you've gone through Athlete's Foot Alley. You get on a flight, you look around, and all of a sudden everybody's taking their clothes off. Well, it's going to be going on in Germany. German nudists will be able to start their holidays early by stripping off on the plane when they take up on a new offer from an East German travel firm. Naked alert. Now, at the same time, in Brazil, as millions of revelers across Brazil prepare for carnival festivities, the country's health ministry began on Sunday its yearly safe sex campaign and the distribution of free condoms. Maybe they'll be giving them out on the airplane in Germany, too. What I want to know is, what about the seat covers? And will there be antibacterial handy wipes? It's strange stuff. But nothing is as strange as George Bush's State of the Union address last night. Veterans care has actually gotten worse under Bush, and yet he's bragging about how he's improved veterans care. His abstinence policies have hurt AIDS efforts around the world, and yet he's bragging about his anti-AIDS efforts. He has clearly. I mean, here, how can America hold itself up as the beacon of liberty and be the country that everyone wants to be like, when you have large chunks of the world where Osama bin Laden is more popular than the United States? And this was, by the way, not the case on 9/11. On 9/11, George Bush had an opportunity. He had about a week-long window there where he could have brought the world together the same way that Bill Clinton brought America together after the bombing of the Murrah building, the federal building in Oklahoma City. Here you had a Christian fundamentalist, Tim McVeigh, who had read the Turner Diaries, a novel about how a white Protestant guy blows up a federal building, and it causes the federal government to overreact by rounding up all the guns from everybody, which causes the good white Christian Protestants to rise up with their guns and start killing off government, all the government agents, killing off the police, and killing off people of color and Jews. This is the story of the Turner Diaries, and that's what Tim McVeigh thought was going to happen. And instead, Bill Clinton said, "We're not going to declare war on you. Come on, you're a bug. You're a criminal. You're a nutcase. We're going to put you in jail." And in fact, he was even executed. And the families in Oklahoma City got closure, and the nation got to take a deep breath. And, yes, there was some legislation hastily passed that I think was ill-advised, but by and large, our rights were intact. And George Bush, after 9/11, could have said to the world, there are some loonies out there, these fundamentalists, just like Tim McVeigh in the Christian religion, you got some loonies in the Muslim religion. I reach out to the Muslim world, help us help you find these people. And in fact, the Taliban said, we will give you Osama bin Laden as long as he goes to a third country where he'll get a fair trial. And Bush said, no, we don't want Osama bin Laden. We don't want to end this thing. We don't want people to have class. At that point, there were only about 20,000 people who were supporters of Osama bin Laden. Most people had never even heard his name. But as anybody who's ever studied drama knows, in order to have a hero, you have to have an anti-hero. And the hero is only as good as the anti-hero. Superman would not be a big deal if there wasn't Lex Luthor and Kryptonite. The Batman would not be a big deal if there wasn't the Joker and the Riddler. You've got to have an anti-hero. So in order for George Bush, a guy who was appointed by the Supreme Court, who got 5 million fewer votes than Al Gore did in the election, who was widely viewed as an illegitimate president and was horribly unpopular in the United States, the way for him to become a hero was to turn Osama bin Laden into an anti-hero, into something larger than life. And so he said, no, we won't take you. We won't take Osama bin Laden when the Taliban offered him. He said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go to war. We're going to have a war. War presidents have power. War presidents have popularity. And instead of uniting the world, I mean, keep in mind the French, the day, Le Monde, the day after 9/11, the headline and the largest newspaper in France was, "We are all Americans now." In Tehran, Iran, they were holding candlelight vigils in support of the United States and our leadership, which included George Bush. We could have brought the world together. And instead, George W. Bush drove the world apart and has put democracy at risk all over the world as a consequence of it. And what are we doing? We're empowering dictators like the military dictator Musharraf in Pakistan and like the murderous dictators in communist China, who we now owe so much money to that they could throw our economy into the toilet tomorrow, and we can't even make a cruise missile without parts that we had to buy from China. The only country, by the way, in the last 15 years or so that I know of that has actually threatened us with nuclear weapons. He continues to want to tap your phones and my phones and members of Congress's phones without warrants. God forbid he should have to go before a judge and explain. Well, here's, you know, we've got some evidence here. See, that's just, you know, what the Fourth Amendment says. We, you know, what it is. That's kind of quaint. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched, the persons or things to be seized. No, no, we got to be able to snoop on anybody, including the Democratic Party. He wants immunity. He wants immunity for himself and for his buddies in the telco industry. I mean, it's incredible. Terry in Los Angeles. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
You know, I find that you're only one of a few people that talk about tariffs, and it's very interesting because
tariffs. Yeah, hardly. I'm one of only a few people on the right and the left who talk about economics, frankly.
Exactly.
Which I think is unfortunate because that's the basis of the whole thing. When you get down to all, at the very bottom line, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, it's all about who has the money.
Yeah. And I find it very frustrating. I've been in the Democratic Party for years, and I've talked about tariffs and, you know, how, you know, in the 1800s that was the big fight, you know, free trade with, you know, the British and everything.
Yep.
1700s And nobody seems to grasp it. The Democrats, that is the problem, is that the Democrats don't know economics hardly any better than the Republicans. It's like, it's so aggravating to me.
Yeah, what the Republicans know about economics is wrong. It demonstrably doesn't work. What the Democrats know about about economics is missing. They couldn't tell you what John Maynard Keynes had to say if their life depended on it. So yeah, your point is well taken, Terry. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Randy in New Jersey. Hey, Randy, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Good
to talk to you.
Thank you. What's up?
I'm curious because, I mean, you're making all of these points about the Republican speech. Don't you think the Democrats during their rebuttal should make these points?
Yes.
The last good rebuttal we had was from Webb.
Yeah, I agree. I think Sebelius should have taken him apart. She should have totally deconstructed. You know, the surge. He's bragging about the escalation, calling it a surge. He's saying we're going to draw down 20,000 troops, but we cranked it up by 30,000, right? So we're still above pre-surge or pre-escalation levels. And now you've got the Army Chief of Staff George Casey saying that, quote, "The current demand for our forces exceeds the sustainable supply." The surge, quote, "The surge has sucked all the flexibility out of the system." I mean, yesterday, Petraeus, quote, "The Pentagon wants to bring home troops quickly to reduce the strain on the armed services." You've got this guy has broken our military, and somehow he's bragging about it. The surge has not worked. Violence may be down, but our troops are still dying in Iraq, and Iraq is not, by any stretch of the imagination, free or safe. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are regrouping all across South Asia, particularly in Afghanistan. It just goes on and on and on. You know, he mentioned Katrina. I mean, give me a break. I'm surprised people didn't just barf right then and there.
So how come we don't have anybody saying anything? How come we keep getting these guys who have the chance to make these rebuttals or these women, whatever, and they get on there and they say nothing?
Yeah.
They patronize. I don't get it. It's no wonder nobody wants to vote for a Democrat.
My guess is that the governor want. She came out and endorsed Barack Obama this morning. And this is not an indictment of Barack Obama. He's a great guy. His campaign, however, or not however, his campaign has been run largely on generalities and staying above the fray. In other words, on inspirational messages. And I think that what she was trying to do was strike a Barack Obama-friendly or a Barack Obama-consistent, positive, inspirational note. And, you know, I congratulate her for having that as a goal. I don't think that she did it, number one. And number two, I find no problem, I have no problem at all with taking names and kicking ass. And I think that that's is absolutely what the Democrats needed to be doing yesterday, rather than saying, you know, there's going to be all these commentators commenting on this, quack, quack, quack. I think that they needed to be kicking butt. They needed to be, you know, like FDR said, you know, it's...
And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
That's what we need to be saying.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes before the hour. Ellen Renner with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Let's get a few insights from a genuine reporter here. TalkRadioNews.com, their website. A new and improved and fabulous app, actually. Ellen, welcome.
Well, thanks a lot. Actually, a lot going on in Washington. The FISA bill has got everybody up in arms in the Senate.
What's the status of that right now? What's going on with
it? Well, it looks like there were two votes, and they both failed. And so it does not look like they're going to get even a 30-day extension. Now, it's interesting. Mitch McConnell was very much in favor of this 30-day extension, but the president this morning threw at the morning gaggle, and that was no briefing today, just the morning gaggle said to us that, not the president, but the president's spokesperson said to us that there was, in fact, going to be a veto of even a 30-day extension, that they had 6 months to pull this off, and they needed to do pull off the FISA bill.
We're now back to the old rules. He can wiretap anybody he wants, but within 3 days he has to go to a judge. And what they did before is still criminal.
Well, that's exactly what I think the Democrats want there to be to the old rules, because the old rules mean that they have to go to a judge. And Helen Thomas this morning said, why not just go to a judge?
Right.
And they said, well, the president needs the tools and all this kind of, you know, malarkey, frankly.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why the old rules don't work.
Yeah, there was
you have to go to the FISA court, except for the fact that, as some of the attorneys have told me, that they knew that they would have never gotten a court order from the FISA court to wiretap attorneys. And they think that this whole thing is about wiretapping attorneys, not the bad guys, but the attorneys for the bad guys, because the FISA court will never agree to just wholesale tap attorneys.
Oh, that's interesting. You know who I think the FISA court never would have authorized a wiretap to? Democratic politicians. I think that George Bush has been doing what Richard Nixon was doing, and he's afraid of getting caught at it.
Well, that certainly would impeach him pretty fast.
I know, and that's why I think that he has been working so hard to keep this thing from ever seeing the light of day, why people won't show up for subpoenas, why they're defying Congress. I mean, if it was just about wiretapping attorneys, I think that they would just take their lickings. But if they're wiretapping Democrats, I mean, you know, there was that guy in Orrin Hatch's office who hacked into Teddy Kennedy's computer for over a year, was reading Teddy Kennedy's email and sharing it with the House, with the Senate Republican
Congress.
Right,
I remember that. Of course.
They all the Republicans knew about that. They all knew that they were spying on the Democrats. Everybody, and nobody said a word for a year. every single Republican member of the Senate. You know, they had to have known it because it was being circulated among their caucus. And finally, when that guy got outed, got busted, Orrin Hatch fired him, and that was the end of it. But there was never any investigation. I mean, you know, this was Nixonian. And to think that Bush wouldn't and the Republicans wouldn't continue doing that with telephones after they'd already done it with computers to a Senate colleague, to think that they wouldn't be doing it to people in the House of Representatives by telephone, I think it's just naive.
Well, it's an interesting theory. I don't know that. I mean, I just find it hard to believe that even Bush would go that far.
Well, but nobody could believe that Nixon would either. That's you know,
true.
That's why before the White House tapes came out, none of the Republicans were willing to vote for impeachment, and only half the Democrats were. Once they heard the White House tapes, they said, "Holy cow, this is it." I think that's what's going to happen.
Clearly he's been wiretapping somebody that the FISA court will never, ever give permission, whether it's lawyers or Democrats. The FISA court would have never given permission for them to wiretap whoever they've been wiretapping.
But see, I don't think that they would cover it up if it was just the lawyers. I think that they would say, well, you know, we made a mistake, or, well, we've got a reason, or, you know, yeah, we shouldn't have, but. But if it's Democrats, then it's impeachable. Then it's a political crime, and they're putting too much effort into this for anything other than a political, in my personal opinion. But, you know, I may be just a conspiracy nut. Anyhow, there's other news in Washington.
Yeah, there is other news. In about 15 minutes, the president is going to sign the executive order on earmarks. This is going to be dealing with earmarks associated with various federal agencies. This is going to be very interesting, Tom, because, of course, there's a lot of objection actually coming from the Republicans and Mitch McConnell and others. So this is something that the president is doing but is not necessarily getting the full support of his party.
Well, on top of that, why is the president making legislation? I thought Congress was supposed to make legislation. I mean, I was amazed last night when everybody applauded when he said it.
Well, I don't think everybody applauded. It's interesting because I think this will go right up to the Supreme Court, just like the whole issue of line item veto went.
You betcha.
Will go to the Supreme Court faster than the speed of light, and I cannot imagine that the Supreme Court, even though it's stacked in terms of executive power, is not going to find for the Congress on this.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's clearly unconstitutional, I think. But, hey,
yeah.
I'm not a constitutional lawyer.
Yeah.
The president is also saying that the Senate bill on the on what's happening with the financial package wants to put in more money for food stamps and more money for unemployment. The House bill that passed does not, and so there's going to be some conference about that, and two, even a question of whether it's even going to pass the Senate. And the longer it goes, of course, the longer before any of this money filters down to anybody. Not that it's necessarily going to do the trick. The White House is saying that it is it's deep enough that it actually will do the trick.
It'll do the trick just in time for the elections, which will help the Republicans.
Well, and of course, today is the Republican primary in Florida, which is a fight to the death. Mm-hmm. And I have to also say, yesterday I was up for the whole speech, and we were in Statuary Hall, and I asked a lot of people who I know who are staff people to Democrats, often staff people to Democrats, who are well known to support Hillary Clinton, and a lot of those people are voting for Obama. This is going to be very, very interesting.
Yeah, I think that the Kennedy family's endorsement of Barack Obama yesterday was an earthquake. It was a political earthquake. So
It's certainly going to change the political landscape for a few weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. I look forward to hearing from you a little later on today, Ellen, about Darfur.
You will.
Okay, great. Good talking
Thank
with
you.
You. Thanks so much for being on the line with us. It's at talkradionews.com, the website. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations.
Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Martin Strong is with us, a former Navy SEAL for 20 years, a security analyst and terrorism consultant, member of the Secretary of Defense's Military and Terrorism Analyst Forum. He's also the vice president of a company you may have heard of, Blackwater USA. Martin Strong, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm wondering why Blackwater is providing security for the Secretary of State and American dignitaries when, since the founding of this republic, we did it with the U.S. Marine Corps.
Actually, we've been doing it with Special Operations Forces up until 9/11. Both the SEALs and the Green Berets and the Army were assigned to protect U.S. diplomats when they went into very, very harmful areas, places that were war zones, et cetera. And the current contract that we're on was started during the Clinton administration almost 18 years ago. And the first three, 5-year contracts were won by a company called DynCorp, and that was to augment diplomatic security in the State Department. So it's morphed a couple of times.
I understand that, but and if you go back to the 18th and 19th centuries, it was the Marine Corps and even the 20th century, as I recall. But in any case, the essence of my question is, when we have a military service that is answerable to we the people, that is clearly defined under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, why should we go to a private for-profit corporation whose first loyalty by law, the Dodge versus Ford Michigan Supreme Court decision, has to be answerable to profit first, to their stockholders first. Why should we go to that kind of an institution to provide security for our diplomats and other people's diplomats?
Well, I can't answer about the stockholders thing. In the case of our company, we're a privately owned company. There's no board of directors or stockholders that have to be answered to.
Then you have to answer to Eric Prince. I mean, certainly he's doing this for a profit.
I would say that's probably maybe three or four down on his list of reasons why he does this. When he first started the company in 1997, it did not make very much money. It barely turned a profit. They paid payroll out of their personal ATM accounts to try to make ends meet. And that went on for many, many years. I mean,
well, that's true of most entrepreneurs. I mean, I've done the same thing, but that doesn't mean that you don't do it because you hope someday to make a profit. Are you suggesting that a private individual, that we should place our security in the hands of a private individual because he happens to be a good guy? What happened to democracy?
Well, I can remember a time when Abraham Lincoln tried to get to his inaugural, and he couldn't find anybody to protect him except for the Pinkertons, who were a private sector solution to protecting the new president of the United States. I mean,
you're talking about during the Civil War?
Yes, this has been going a long, long time. The private sector has produced all the battleships.
I don't think we're experiencing a civil war right now.
Excuse me?
We're not experiencing a civil war right now.
No, but we've been a very, very flexible democracy, and you use the term, so I'm going to go ahead and continue with that. And in a
democracy, or republic, if you prefer.
What's that?
Or republic, if you prefer. It's
or
a democratic
republic. But during the 1990s, our democracy, our U.S. government administration decided to cut the U.S. military, at least the Army, in half by dropping 450,000 troops. They threw the weight of the future wars on most of the National Guard and the reserves, and they got rid of a huge number of bases that were also used for training recruits and training people such as special forces, et cetera. So democracies, and our democracy especially, has made changes in a cyclical nature ever since its founding. And at the end of the 90s, without any training bases around in the country anymore, Eric Prince decided to create a training base, and that was essentially what we started. And when 9/11 occurred, and the U.S. Special Operations Forces, who at that time had a collateral duty assignment to protect VIPs around the world, their main focus at that time was to hunt al-Qaeda. So they were taken off the administrative duties of protecting diplomats and assigned to pure warfighting duties. And that's why we ended up seeing security companies being brought in by the U.S. government to continue on what had occurred in the late 90s with the outsourcing of
I understand what you're saying, that the Clinton administration cut back on this and that there was a military need. The Jefferson administration, Thomas Jefferson, thought we should have no standing army whatsoever during time of peace. When he became president in 1800, we had about 300,000 men in the army. He cut it down to around 6,000. And some suggest that, James Madison, the president following him, when the British and the Canadians attacked during the War of 1812, was woefully underprepared for that and blamed Jefferson, perhaps appropriately, for that. But Madison didn't go out and say, somebody, quick, start a for-profit corporation and give me some soldiers. He went out and added to the military.
No, we didn't, although the Founding Fathers did rely on a lot of European contracted specialists to help with the training of our revolutionary forces at Yorktown. And
well, we had mercenaries during the Revolutionary War.
And in the case, and that term is exactly right. A mercenary works for a foreign power, being paid by a foreign power. Even the UN says the current definition that you have to be paid by a foreign power and not a party to the conflict, which certainly doesn't classify U.S. citizens with security clearances being paid by the U.S. government on contract as mercenaries. But, you know, you mentioned Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson believed in no entanglements. He was the first president to project our power to fight the pirates, the Barbary pirates in Tripoli, hence the Marine Corps song. So the very first use of extension of power was by the very president who thought it was not going to be necessary and it would be a problem. And
yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. But again, he didn't hire a private corporation to do that. The Bush administration has paid you guys more than $320 million since June of 2004 just to provide diplomatic service, security services. I don't get it why we're paying a private corporation to make a good profit. And Blackwater is very profitable and growing very well. Why we're paying a private corporation to make a profit for something that we should be doing that should be answerable to us? I mean, you guys are operating in Iraq, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, under rules where you're not answerable to the Iraqi government, you're not answerable to the United States government, you're not operating under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, you're not operating under U.S. Law, as it were, specifically. There's, you know, all these gray areas that are going on. There's a lot of debate about it. I'm not saying that's your fault. You know, it's clearly L. Paul Bremer had something to do with this in the Bush administration. But it just seems like a mess that's happening here.
Well, it is unprecedented as far as the security protection in a war zone, because if you remember the recent history, I mean, when I was in, we used to do things where if there was a problem in a country, the State Department would issue warnings. We'd stop the flow of U.S. citizens into the country. We then start to reduce the number of citizens there. Then we start to reduce the staff at embassies. And at some point, the Marines would come in and they'd pull the ambassador and his small staff out. In the case of Iraq, we did the exact opposite. We flowed 5,000 to 7,000 U.S. government practitioners of democratization and reconstruction into a war zone, into an unstable environment that maintained an insurgency at least for two and a half years at a pretty steady clip. But at the same time, how do these U.S. emissaries run around and do business and help the Iraqi people? The only way to do that was to protect them when they were outside of the green zone. And so there's a lot of things that were unprecedented in this, but it wasn't all bad. I don't think it was all
I'm not saying you guys are the Prince of Darkness or something. I'm just saying that it seems, for example, you pay your guys, this Jeremy Scahill reporting in The Nation, and I know you guys probably think of him as your nemesis, but as far as I can tell, the stats are right. He says you were paying your guys $600 a day, and under a contract from Regency, who was being paid $815 per day per person, Regency was then billing a company called ESS, an unknown amount. ESS was being paid $1,500 a man from the federal government. I mean, we got all these middlemen, all these people making money off what's going on in Iraq. Harry Truman, you know, challenged FDR. He was a senator, and he said, if there's anybody making money on World War II, I want to know about it, and we want to put an end to it. And Franklin Roosevelt said, okay, do it. They put together the Truman Commission, said, you know, if we've got war profiteers, we're going to put them in jail.
Sure. Well, Jeremy Scahill actually doesn't know anything about Blackwater, never interviewed anybody at Blackwater, and some of the things that he's quoted in his book are circa 2002, 2003, when the United States government was scrambling trying to figure out how to even begin to contract these services. It is completely different and has been completely different for several years. There's a lot of concern about how much the contractors are being paid, and the reality is that the average guy is probably making about $150,000 total per year because he doesn't work the entire year. The day rate,
which is nothing compared to what you were making when you were a Navy SEAL. I mean, which is a huge compared to what you were making as a Navy SEAL.
The current Navy SEALs and special ops with their bonuses and the fact that it's tax-free, 100% tax-free in the war zones where it isn't for the contractors, they're making between $100,000 and $120,000.
Then let's hire more of them.
Well, that's easier said than done. Myself, having been an instructor, both as an enlisted and as an officer, 75-80% attrition, and they have to volunteer to go to war first.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Okay, well, thank you for coming by with us. Martin Strong, Vice President of Blackwater USA, blackwaterusa.com, of course, the website. Appreciate the conversation, sir.
All right, Tom. Take care.
Have a good one. 16 minutes past the hour.
Truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We built the tanks and ships that saved the world in darkest throes. Back when our gunmen fought for the rights of mankind, not just some CEOs. When a simple, decent living is right that we all share, when the suits see us as people, not just assets to be paired, when they can't just ship your job off, 'cause it's happening everywhere. That is one big union.
21 minutes past the hour. Our quote for the day, if there must be trouble, let it be in my day, that my child may have peace. That from Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine's birthday today. My mom's birthday today, too. A lot of birthdays for the day. By the way, you can give our comment line a call if you want, 202-536-5306. You can find also that number over at tomhartman.com on our contact page. Just keep it under 30 seconds. Your comments might make it on the air, 202-536-5306. And, boy, was that spooky. After talking to the VP of Blackwater, an ad for The Nation comes on. I had no control over that. That was not planned at all. But it's like Mercury's retrograde. Anything that can go wrong will go wrong, or anything that can go weird will go weird. That was downright strange. Anyhow, Mike in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Sorry to have to correct you and especially the vice president of Blackwater there.
Yeah,
but
please do. You wanted to talk about the cuts during the Clinton administration, and I didn't have the numbers in front of me, but my understanding is that Clinton cut back on some of the things like the Star Wars stuff, but not that he cut back on the number of people under arms.
True. This all began right before the Persian Gulf War, and the Bush administration back then was going to cut back on the military.
Right.
And I have a quote from a Soldier's Magazine that's published by the Army Public Affairs Division, and it's just one comment. The military will lose 348,000 members, more than half of them soldiers, by 1995. The Army must reduce to 535,000 active duty troops, and this is from the July 1991 issue.
So, in other words, there was a cutback in forces, and it did happen during the Clinton administration, but it was put into place by the George Herbert Walker Bush administration.
Right. It was going to take a total of about 4 or 5 years to totally reduce it. They couldn't whack 535,000 all at once.
Yeah.
It was going to take 4 or 5 years to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Mike, thanks a lot for the correction, and now I know. I appreciate
it. All right, Tom. Thanks
a
lot. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too. I tell you, we've got the smartest listeners on earth for this program. I am so appreciative of that. Dave in Indiana. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, he beat me to it. I was just going to mention that it was part of the FY93 budget, which took place just before, that's October 1st, before the election.
Right.
And they were going to, you know, cut by about 50%, and they were going to make up for the deficit by using the, I guess he might have said National Guard, no reserve. They're going to beef up the reserve. The Navy was going to wait for about 3 or 4 years before they started cutting them.
Yeah. And this was because the Soviet Union fell not on the watch of Ronald Reagan, but on the watch of George Herbert Walker Bush. And so he was saying, okay, no more Soviet Union. Let's cut back on our military forces.
Yeah. And then when Bush was running for office, they had all their charts. They had a hearing, and they had all the charts in front of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Congress and saying, oh, look, all the cuts during the Clinton administrations. And one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff stood up and said, wait a minute. You guys were the ones that put that into place.
Mm.
If you remember back right after the Gulf War, they were talking about drafting medical people.
Yeah.
Because I was in the medical field, and before I retired in 94, and my job was to find out, they were trying to outsource as much military care or medical care from the military
right.
as possible. And that's what I was able to do, get all that information.
Well, I guess, to his credit, Mr. Strong, who, the VP of Blackwater, did not try to politicize it. He didn't say Clinton did this. He said it happened in the 90s. And that's
right.
what you guys are all saying.
Because a lot of people still think, oh, Clinton, reduction was Clinton, but it wasn't. And yeah. even when I was in towards the end, right after the first Gulf War, if people reenlisted and they wanted people out so bad that if people just enlisted, if they weren't in a critical job, you could turn around and get right out again. They wanted people out so bad.
Yeah, okay. Hey, right, thanks. Thanks a lot for the heads up. I do appreciate it. Chuck in Seattle. Hey, Chuck.
Yeah, how you doing? I'm a United States Marine. I spent 6 years in. I'm service-connected, disabled, so I'm really not doing much right now. But I listen to you every day, Tom, and, you know, I think he was exaggerating on the training needed to guard some dignitaries. I don't think that everybody has to be a UDT SEAL and do underwater demolitions and stuff like that to
in order to walk around in a bazaar with John McCain.
That's right. I don't think he needs 20 UDT SEALs following him around, but I'm sure that Marines have always handled embassies, and we always did, and I just think that...
That's what I thought. I thought that the Marine Corps was created, actually, in part, to protect our embassies around
the world. Well, we're the oldest ground force around, but the point I wanted to make is, you know, back when he got in, you know, 20-something years ago, and when I got in, they were taking kids that were getting in trouble, you know, and instead of filling up our prisons, why don't we give a kid another chance? You know, now you got to have a high school diploma and you can't stray over the line. It turned me around, you know, and really made me a good citizen.
Well, good on you, Chuck.
Be a Marine.
Good on you, Chuck. And thank you for your service to our country. And frankly, in a funky kind of way, I mean, by lowering standards to get people into the military, they may well be saving a lot of lives. They may well be turning a lot of people around. So, I think that there's probably two sides to that argument. 27 minutes past the argument. All right, past the minute.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Program, listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors and our stations. Our sponsors, including the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Well, the primary is going on in Florida. It's going to be an interesting evening to find out, is it going to be... Is Rudy Giuliani toast? I have a feeling this is going to be the absolute end of his, certainly of his political aspirations. I started to say his political career. I wouldn't say that altogether, although that's my guess. I think he's just going to go back to making money. And, you know, just like a good Republican. You use politics to set it up, and then, you know, like Trent Lott, you know, resigning a year early so that he could avoid the oversight rules, and he could go directly into being a multimillion-dollar-a-year lobbyist. And so, anyhow. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Gene in San Francisco, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Gene.
Hi, Tom. We got to get rid of those lobbyists, boy.
Them under control anyway. Just limit their ability to give money to politicians. That would be a good starting point.
Yeah, you've been having such great topics today. I wanted to say about that Blackwater VP's misleading use of the definition of the word mercenary.
Mm-hmm.
I think Blackwater soldiers are not all U.S. citizens. They hire a lot of foreign recruits as their soldiers. And I think the only major thing about Blackwater is that it probably has incorporation papers in the United States. And so I'd say that their soldiers still could be called mercenaries. That would be the more honest use of the word.
It could be. I mean, my take on this is the same as like my take on Walmart, for example, which is that I'm not suggesting that, and I wouldn't, that what the corporation is doing is wrong or that they don't have a right to exist or something like that. It's rather that we are setting the rules of the game that allow for it. And essentially that was the point that Mr. Strong made, was that there was a need, that the military had a need. It created an opportunity. Eric Prince saw that opportunity and said, hey, I can make some bucks on this, and did so. And that's the American way. I mean, you know, we want people to be doing that, broadly speaking, to see business opportunities and take them. On the other hand, there are things, frankly, that I think, you know, like protection of dignitaries and things like that, that we have historically done with our military, and that our military is accountable for under the UCMJ and under U.S. law, and when overseas, under overseas law, and that these private contractors, and it's not just Blackwater, by the way, it's a whole bunch of them, apparently are not accountable for.
Well,
we need to have a national debate about this.
He seems to want to make it seem like it's totally secure because they're not mercenaries. But many of those soldiers they've hired from foreign countries are mercenaries. It might be a technicality,
yeah,
but it's still true. And can I ask you a question about the
sure.
State of the Union speech? Your other guests posed the problem of why no questions were asked. And the I want to ask, has this annual speech always been used as a political propaganda tool like Bush has used it every time? And is it maybe illegal to use it for pure propaganda purposes like promoting the invasion of Iraq? And is that impeachable?
Number one, has it always been political? Broadly, no. I mean, certainly you could argue that George Washington's was not political. Probably from that time forward, there was some tinge of that to it. But, you know, Section 3 of the Constitution of Article 2 says, this is the part that deals with the president. He shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. And, you know, the problem that I had last night was I didn't hear much about the State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did hear was, you know, a lot of code and a lot of posturing, frankly, and a lot of recycled stuff. But, you know, that clause in the Constitution is really quite vague. It doesn't even require an annual one. It says from time to time. And, you know, so presumably it could even be done once in a four-year term. And so I don't think that we can make a constitutional argument against George Bush and what he did. But and certainly, you know, I guarantee you, and this was not the first political State of the Union address. And there's a lot of Republicans who you know, went hysterical about some of the ones that Roosevelt gave, for example, back in the 30s when he was passing Social Security and things like that. So no, but there were a number of points in there where, frankly, I think he was just laying stuff out that was either wrong or lies. And that's frankly what offended me. Gene, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Eugenia in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Eugenia. Or Ina, excuse me.
Ina, yeah. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Ina.
Question about Bush's statement about globalization, about bringing Canada and Mexico into a meeting. And is this dangerous for our economy? Is this going to bring us, the state of our economy down to, like, Mexico's? And also, I want
yeah.
to thank
and you. Yeah, and we're on that trajectory. And it's also bringing Mexico up. You know, the richest guy in the Northern Hemisphere now is no longer Bill Gates. It's a guy named by the name of Carlos Slim, who's a Mexican.
Wow. So the thing is, I'm finding that a lot of Democrats are for this too.
Yeah. Yeah. The DLC, the Republican light branch of the Democratic Party, and you know, a number of Democrats think that this is just the greatest thing since sliced bread because it makes a lot of money for big multinational corporations, which then gets recycled back into campaign contributions. And that's the problem. Globalization is quite simply, a gift to transnational corporations and a penalty to individual nation states and the people living in them. Ken in Louisville, Texas. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
The one thing that Alan Radner brought up that really gets my goat, I guess, is where he demanded that Congress cut earmarks by 50% and what I find interesting about that, I get off of Think Progress, which notes that when the Republicans took office, earmarks were at about 4,000, and by the next year, they were at 15,000 on appropriation bills. But what's even further...
Right, the number of earmarks.
Yeah, the number of earmarks. And the thing that really gets me is that even this last year, there were 580 earmarks that Bush put in himself, including
right.
a $21 million Laura Bush Century Library and Program and an $8 million program for Points of Light, which his dad started.
Right. Yeah. What I was yelling at the TV when he said that was, yeah, you want to cut out the 50% of the earmarks that were put in by the Democrats.
And he's demanding that the federal government be as responsible as American citizens. Where has he been for the last 7 years?
Yeah. Yeah. Well said, Ken. Thank you very much. Bob in Santa Ana, California. Hey, Bob.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Listen, in lieu of the Edward Kennedy endorsement yesterday, I was just wondering, because you have such a great understanding of history, what your general feeling was about endorsements and whether or not historically there was anyone, you know, that you might be able to cite that maybe had a huge impact or might have been considered to be decisive or anything like that?
That's a good question, Bob. Nothing immediately comes to mind in terms of historic endorsements. I don't pretend to be a scholar of endorsements and frankly of the political dimension of history as much as, you know, just the historical dimension of it, other than the founding of this country, which frankly wasn't all that political in the early days. I mean, there were factions, but I think that when the Kennedy family, not just Teddy Kennedy, but also the daughter of John Kennedy, who has gone out of her way throughout her life to live a very private life, a very non-political life. When a person of her stature and her credibility, you know, viewed by many people as not a political hack. I mean, you know, there are many who are going to say, Teddy Kennedy, yeah, he's a political hack. He's a politician. He's, you know, you can't, you know, quack, quack, quack. You can't take anything seriously. You know, all the things that people say about politicians. You can't say any of that about Caroline Kennedy. And
that's exactly right, yeah.
And so when she comes out and then Teddy Kennedy comes out and you have basically the entire Kennedy family bestowing the legacy of Jack Kennedy on Barack Obama, I see that as I think the phrase I used earlier was an earthquake, and perhaps I borrowed it from some other pundit. I don't know. But I think that it is a major, major turning point in the Obama campaign and perhaps in the entire Democratic campaign. And I haven't heard peep from the Clinton campaign since then. I think, you know, and I don't just think this was Teddy Kennedy doing payback to Bill for misbehaving or behaving in an unseemly fashion. I think that this was a genuine thing. So anyhow, Bob, thanks for the call. Is it Gila in Miami, Florida, or Gila?
Gila, yes.
Gila.
Correct.
Hey, Gila.
I just wanted to make a comment about this Martin Strong. I don't know if it was specifically him, but there was an interview on the local progressive radio station. I believe it was with him. It may have been someone else from Blackwater. And I don't know if you were aware that Blackwater seems to be doing a major PR campaign.
Oh, they absolutely are. We had him on because they solicited us. They sent us a news release asking to be
right,
on the
yeah,
program.
It was the same thing with the local station.
Yeah. Yeah, they're, you know, Blackwater's out there knocking on doors and trying to get the good message out. And you know, I mean, I wasn't going to do a hit job on him. I just thought these are legitimate questions that need to be part of the American discussion. And frankly, I'm not hearing as part of the American discussion, you know, but I wasn't even the one who raised the word mercenary. You know,
mm-hmm.
He brought that up, I think, anticipating that I might. Because probably that's the word that most often is used as a negative against them, that is thrown at them. And I wasn't going down that road. I just think that there are a lot of things that the government does better. You know, I want the police to be working for me. I want the fire department to be working for me. You know, without a middleman who's making a dividend, and without a middleman who's some CEO making $1 million salary that I can never talk to, I want them working for me through my elected officials who I can throw out on their butts if they don't do a good job. And I want the military to be the same. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, participate in our message board and our blogs. There's also a blog over at AirAmerica.com. And our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Chuck in Florida. Hey, Chuck. What's up?
Hey, Tom.
Well, for one thing, we've been listening to Air America since the very beginning. We've been streaming it on computer ever since day one.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, we're just really ticked off Howard Dean and the DNC right now for denying us a right to pick a candidate for the United States.
Yeah, so are the folks in Michigan.
And we did go ahead and vote today regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I, we both voted for Hillary basically because she was the only one that said she's going to come in back into Florida as soon as this thing is over. So that kind of swayed our votes toward her.
That's interesting. I mean, Barack Obama yesterday said that he was not going to go into Florida because they all promised not to, and he was keeping a promise. Hillary made that promise, too. She showed up in Florida yesterday or today, but says she's not campaigning. You think that's a good thing?
I don't think any of them should have made the pledge to begin with. I mean, first of all,
but the Florida Democratic Party had agreed to play by the rules, and then they broke the rules.
But it was a Republican legislature in Florida, though, that decided to advance the date for the primaries.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, it's controlled by the Republicans. The House and the Senate are controlled by Republicans, and they were the ones who decided to raise the the date up. And
okay,
so the
Democrats
had to follow along.
Yeah, okay. In that context, then, yeah, I understand. Okay, I'm with you. Interesting. Okay, Chuck, thanks a lot for the heads up and for your comments, and thanks for that bit of information. I was I guess in retrospect I was aware of it. I just hadn't put all the pieces together. Ruth in New York City. Hey, Ruth.
Hi, Tom. The Blackwater thing.
Hmm?
I think that's because they don't want to reinstate the draft because they're using private armies. So why does a private army have that kind of authority? Isn't there a law against it?
Well, the UN, there's actually an international convention against the use of mercenaries, but the catch is that the United States is not a signatory to it. So,
yeah, but isn't there a law here in our country, in the United States, against private armies? As I remember, because they're vigilantes. They're lawless.
Yeah, it's a matter of definition. I mean, you know, Pinkerton was, as Martin Strong pointed out, Pinkerton was around for a long time, and they did some pretty nasty stuff, by the way. They busted up strikes and killed a few strikers and things like that back in the 1880s. But they were started largely as a security force to bust up unions.
Yeah.
And then they became a security company, But whether something's an army or a security force or a private police department, I mean, you know, whether they're the Walmart police, you know, the guys who are walking through the malls or whatever, I mean, you know, there's all these different gradations. And frankly, as I said, I think that we need to be having a conversation about this in the United States rather than just, you know, saluting the flag on it, rather than just accepting it. But, Ruth, you're raising some good and important issues. Thank you very much for doing so. Cindy in Montana. Hey, Cindy.
Hi. Glad to talk to you. I've been holding on for quite a long time.
Yes,
okay.
And thank you so much.
What I was concerned about is I read in the local newspaper that 40,000 tons or 40,000 pounds of bombs were dropped on the farmlands in Iraq, and that there were burning citrus groves and burning fields. And my question is this. Are the oil companies trying to make this a one big oil field with unlivable land except around the Baghdad area, and all these bombs are going to have to be replaced, 40,000 tons or pounds or whatever it was, and now you have defense contractors having to replace that and making tons of money off of it. And I would like to know why they bother to drop those bombs in Iraq on the farmlands.
Iraq's farmland. Cindy, I don't know the details of that. I have seen reports like that. The bottom line, this has been a very, very, very profitable war for the American defense contractors. It's been a very politically profitable war for George Bush and for the Republican Party to an extent up until the last couple of years. At least it started out that way. It helped them in the 2002 election. It helped them in the 2004 election.
Is this what we do when we liberate people? We ruin their countries?
Apparently.
And take away their ability to raise their own food and take away their ability to have a place to live. I think it's just an atrocity.
I absolutely agree, and I think that the Bush administration needs to be held accountable for it, frankly, but they're not. I mean, we're not holding them accountable, and that all the more the tragedy. Thank you for the call, Frank in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Frank.
How you doing?
Just
you know, I suppose most of your listeners probably never listen to Rush Limbaugh, or not very often.
Well,
and
given that he's on the air at the same time I am, I hope not.
Okay.
We've actually beat him in some rating books in some markets, you know, so.
Exactly.
Good,
well,
you know.
I've got one button on Air America and one on Limbaugh station. And yesterday I was listening to Limbaugh. I just thought I'd pass it on. It may have been the day before. And I've always had respect for his ideas. In fact, whichever station I'm listening to, I usually pick up good ideas. But he actually made the statement that he would rather see a Democratic president than John McCain. And then he followed it up with saying that because either way, the country would get screwed up, and he'd rather see it blamed on the Democrats.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, you know, again, I've had respect for most of his ideas, but my goodness, it's obviously someone who cares more about his party than he does the country.
Yeah, well, frankly, I think he cares more about his ideology than he does the country, but that's a whole other thing. But, Frank, thanks for sharing that. Jeez. Coming up tomorrow, Wednesday, on the Tom Hartman Program, Terrence Jeffrey and I are going to mix it up about whether or not students should be paid to learn after school. What happened with the McCain-Romney showdown in Florida? What does it mean? Will there be a Clinton-Obama showdown as well over Florida? Where is that supposed to go? Plus the best of the rest of the news here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.